the Cheyenne Club on the corner of 17th Street and Warren Avenue was established in 1880 by 12 Wyoming cattlemen. Equipped with two wine cellars, double parlors, a dining room, library, smoking room, and billiard room, it was the place to be for cattlemen from all over Wyoming. At the moment, Duff was in one of the club's parlors, enjoying his cigar and a scotch as he engaged in convivial conversation with some of the other cattlemen. While in Cheyenne, Duff always stayed at the Interocean Hotel, which was advertised with some justification as the finest hotel between Chicago and San Francisco. Built by Barney Ford, a black man and former slave, the hotel had hosted such notables as President Grant and General Sherman, writers Charles Dickens and Samuel Clemens, and actors Edwin Booth, Sarah Bernhardt, and Andrew and Rosanna McAllister. The latter two happened to be Duff's cousins.
How's your cattle ranch coming along, Duff?
W.C. Irvine was one of the top cattlemen in Wyoming. He and Duff were with the group of cattlemen enjoying their evening at the club.
I've grass and water. Aye, and there's shelter from the winter's blow. I have everything on my cattle ranch that you might want, except for one thing.
What would that be?
I don't have cattle. Ah, but it's a small oversight.
You think no cattle on a cattle ranch is a small oversight? So tell me, Duff, would no apples in an apple pie be but a bit of an oversight as well?
It is a condition soon to be remedied. I intend to purchase cattle from the Kansas City Cattle Exchange.
Duff, why would you buy stock from the Kansas City Cattle Exchange when you can buy all the cattle you might need right here in Wyoming to start your ranch?
Kansas City is the only place I can buy a certain breed of cattle. A breed that does not now exist in Wyoming, but one which I shall introduce.
If you're talking about Herefords, I'm running them on my own ranch.
No, I'm talking about Angus. Black Angus. Developed in Scotland, they were. An animal far superior to that English breed, Herefords.
Black Angus? Black cows? You're going to fill the range with black cows?
Aye.
They're all black?
Aye. Black as a raven's wing, and shining in the sunlight. Beautiful animals they are. I had them on my place in Scotland.
You make them sound so pretty, you may have to keep a lookout for bull buffalo. Big Buff might come along and make a cuckold of your seed bulls. When are you going to Kansas City?
It is not my plan to go to Kansas City. It is my plan to have them put the cattle on the cars and ship them here to Cheyenne. And then I will drive them up to my ranch.
Well, I wish you good luck with it. Wyoming is a big and empty territory. I expect there's room here for about every breed of cow there is. And the more the merrier, I say. How many head you planning on buying?
500 head, I think.
500? Damn, you're getting a running start, aren't you?
Aye. With this many, I expect that within 5 years, I'll have 5,000 head.
It's going to cost you a ton of money to get started. If you need to borrow some and are willing to take a note on your property, I'd be happy to make you a loan.
'Tis grateful I am for the offer, but I'll be all right.
If the ranch had not made Duff any money yet, his gold mine had, though he had never shared with any of these men the secret of the mine. He knew that the other ranchers had speculated that he may have come from a wealthy family in Scotland, and though it was not true, Duff did nothing to dissuade them from that belief. The fewer people who knew about that mine, the better off he would be. As Duff went in for dinner at the Cheyenne Club, a few blocks away in the Eagle Saloon on 15th Street, Tyler Camden was playing a game of Old Soul. Actually, he would have preferred to be playing a game of poker, but no one would play with him, for he was known to have a vicious temper. Last year, he killed a man in a poker game after the man accused him of cheating. Of course, he had been cheating, but he couldn't let the accusation go unchallenged. Quicker than anyone could react, Camden had reached across the table, grabbed the man by his shirt front, lifted him up, and plunged his knife into the man's ribs. Quick and silent. That man was dead before most of the people in the saloon even knew what had happened. Now, Camden counted out three cards, but he couldn't find a play. The second card of the three was a red nine. There was a black ten on one of the stacks where he could have used the red nine, but the nine was one card down, and thus it was useless to him. Or was it? With a shrug of his shoulders, Camden slipped the red nine out from under the black queen and played it on the black ten. Dingus Camden and Lee and Marvin Mosley came into the saloon then. Seeing his brother playing solitaire, Dingus walked over to him.
Me and Lee and Marvin's gonna take the cards over to Laramie. They got some new sporting girls in at the Rocky Mountain House. You wanna come along?
Nah, I reckon I'll spend a little time with Libby.
She done told you she didn't want nothing to do with you. Why don't you come along with us?
She'll come around.
All right. You're gonna be missing out on a good time. All right, boys. The next local is no more than half an hour from now. Let's go.
Tyler watched him leave, then thought about Libby. He'd seen her go upstairs with a cowboy about half an hour earlier and had tried to get her attention, but she wouldn't look at him. He wasn't worried, though. Once she was through with the cowboy, she'd have to come to him. He'd already intimidated everyone else into staying away from her, so if she wanted to make a living with her whoring, she would have no choice but to accept him. And it was damn well going to be on his own terms, too. He would see to that. Examining the cards he had spread out on the table, he found a needed black five. It didn't matter where it was. It was where he was about to put it that counted. Camden had just played his card when he saw Libby coming down from upstairs. He stood up from the table and walked over to Libby.
That's me and you go upstairs now.
I told you, I ain't going with you no more.
What do you mean you ain't going with me no more? I got the money. I got the money right here.
Camden stuck his hand down in his pocket and pulled out a fistful of dollars.
See? This here's more than enough for you to go upstairs with me.
I don't want nothing to do with you anymore, Camden. And neither do any of the other girls who work here. You get drunk and you hit us. We ain't getting paid to be beat on.
Yeah, well, I ain't drunk now. I'm sober as a judge.
I told you I ain't going upstairs with you, and that's that.
All right, fine. Try to make it without me. Because here's the truth. Excepting for that cowboy that just left, there ain't nobody else gonna touch you with a 10-foot pole. And while you're wasting away to nothing over here, I'll be taking my business to the Tivoli.
The Tivoli! Lots of luck with that. There won't be a woman over there who'll have anything to do with you.
About an hour later, Tyler Camden was in one of the visiting parlors of the Tivoli. He'd already exceeded his 3-drink minimum, and things were not going well for him. He was with two girls, Cindy McFeeters and Polly Fenton, but it seemed that the only thing they wanted to do was talk. Finally, he decided to take matters into his own hands.
Look here, ain't there some rooms up here where we can go?
What do you mean, are there any rooms up here? You are in a room up here, silly.
No, I ain't talking about that. What I'm talking about is a room with a bed, so me and one of you could go split the sheets, and I don't care which one it is, because either one is fine by me.
Polly and Cindy looked confused.
Mr. Camden, is it possible that you don't understand?
Don't understand what?
We don't do that.
What do you mean, don't do that? That's what all whores do, ain't it?
We wouldn't know about that. We aren't whores.
What do you mean you ain't whores? What the hell are you doing up here if you ain't a whore?
Didn't you read the sign on the wall?
No, I didn't read no sign. On account I can't read. What does it say?
It says we are here for conversation only.
Look here, I done spent me $3 since I came up here.
Yes, you have. You spent it on drinks for you and for us.
Well, what the hell? You say I spent it on drinks for you too? Why would I do that if I wasn't planning on getting something out of it?
You have gotten something out of it. You've had our company and our conversation.
That ain't enough. One of you get out of here. The other, stay. If you ain't got no place else to go, we'll just do it here.
We will both leave.
As the two women started to leave, Camden reached out and grabbed the nearest one by the arm. It happened to be Cindy.
You ain't leaving, bitch, till I tell you you can leave.
Reacting quickly, Cindy used her free hand to rake her fingernails across his cheek, leaving four deep and bleeding scratch marks.
Damn you!
Pulling his knife from its sheath, Camden made a quick, totally unexpected slash, cutting open Cindy's throat. Cindy put her hands to her throat. Polly watched in horror as blood gushed through Cindy's fingers. Cindy's eyes rolled up in her head, and she fell. Duff had been at the saloon for about half an hour, during which time he was nursing a single beer and visiting with some of the other customers. He drank only one beer, not because he was cheap, but because he didn't want to get drunk. Duff and all the other patrons of the saloon looked up and saw a woman appear at the railing on the balcony that overlooked the grand floor. There was a man behind her, and he was holding a knife to the woman's neck. The bartender looked concerned.
Polly, what is it? What's going on?
Please help me!
Where's Cindy?
She's dead! He just killed Cindy! He cut her throat!
Is that true, mister? Camden, is it? Did you kill Cindy?
Yeah, name's Camden. Yeah, I killed the other woman.
What'd you go and do that for?
I killed her because I wanted to. And I'm gonna kill this one too! Unless all you empty your pockets and put your money there in the piano player's hat. Piano player, once they do that, you bring it on up to me.
Slowly and deliberately, Duff drew his pistol and pointed it up toward the man who was holding the knife.
Mr. Camden, I'll be for asking you to let the woman go, no.
What's the matter with you? You crazy, mister? Ain't you got eyes? Can't you see that I'm holding a knife to this woman's throat?
Aye, I can see that. But if you will lower your knife and let her go, I'll let you live. If you do not lower your knife, I'm afraid I shall be forced to kill you.
You can shoot me from down there. Hell, if you was to try, you'd more than likely hit the woman. Truth is, there ain't nothing none of you can do.
I'll not be for asking you again.
No? Well, that's good. Now put down the pistol.
Duff slipped his smoking revolver back into his holster.
Polly, are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine.
Polly ran her hand across her face, then pulled it down and looked at the blood on it.
Oh, his blood! I've got his blood on me! I gotta get it off!
She ran back down the hall of the upper balcony so that she could no longer be seen by those below.
Mister, that was a hell of a chance you took with Polly's life. Don't you know you could have hit her? Did you even give it a second thought before you fired?
No, I didn't need a second thought. If I didn't think I could hit him without hitting her, I would not have fired.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that standing here shooting like you done, with a target no bigger than a man's hand and it being better than 100 feet away, that you knew you'd hit him and not her?
Aye.
Well, you killed a monster, and there's no doubt in my mind that he was prepared to and probably would have killed Polly.
Aye. From the moment he held the knife to the lass's neck, she was all but dead. He could not let her go before he left the pub, or he would have been fair game for any of us. And 'tis not likely that he would keep her with him while he was running from the law. So I'm thinking the only thing he could possibly do is kill her once he got out of our sight. He did the only thing that could be done for saving the poor lass.
Hear, hear. Drinks are on the house!
Dingus Camden and Lee and Marvin Mosley were downstairs in the Rocky Mountain House after having enjoyed some time with some of the establishment's companions for gentlemen, as the house described them.
Say, Dingus, why do you think Tyler didn't want to come with us?
Why are you asking me, Lee?
I'm asking you because you're his brother. Me and Marvin ain't nothing but his cousin.
Well, you know him as well as I do. I don't know why he didn't want to come with us.
Yeah, I know why.
Why?
He didn't want to come with us because he's stuck on that whore back at the Eagle. What's her name?
Libby. He ought to know better than to get stuck on a whore. All whores is the same.
No, they ain't.
What do you mean they ain't the same?
Some whores is better than others. When we get there, I think I'll get me a little black-eyed Mexican girl. I like Emma best.
Yeah, not me. I like my whores to be American.
With big tits. Besides, there ain't no difference between a Mexican whore and an Indian whore.
Yeah, sometimes it is hard to tell the difference. I got me a woman one time back in Arizona Territory. Thought she was Mexican, but she turned out to be Indian. You ever had a Mexican whore?
Nope, never had one. Had me an Indian once, though.
Really? I never knew you had, you know, an Indian woman.
You don't know everything I've ever done.
Well, how was she?
What do you mean, how was she? She was Indian. Why don't you ask Dingus how his Indian woman was?
She pissed me off. Told me she was Mexican, but I knew better. That's why I killed her.
Oh, you're lying. You didn't kill her.
Yeah, I did. And I can prove it.
How are you going to prove it?
I got her tit.
You got her tit? I don't believe it.
You don't believe it, huh? What do you think this is?
Dingus reached down into his pocket and pulled out a dry, leathery-looking bag and handed it over to Lee. Lee took it, thinking at first it was simply a rawhide bag. But then he saw a spongy little nub and realized that he was looking at a nipple. This really was a woman's breast.
I'll be damned. Look at this, Marvin. It really is a tit.
I told you it was.
Damn. What are you going to do with it?
I don't know. I was going to make a tobacco pouch, but I don't think I'm going to do it.
Would you sell it?
I reckon I would. What do you give me for it?
$2.
Yeah, all right. Give me $2 and it's yours.
One of the girls came over toward the table carrying a newspaper.
Honey, don't you have a brother named Tyler?
Yeah, why?
You might want to read this.
The headlines jumped out at him.
Magnificent shot fired from 30 yards. The ball had deadly effect. Son of a bitch!
What is it?
We have to go back to Cheyenne.
After buying a mower, Duff visited the Cheyenne office of the Kansas City Cattle Exchange, where he intended to make arrangements to buy a herd. He met with an associate named Terry Kahn.
Well, I don't know. Most of the business I do is with the local cattlemen arranging to buy their herds. I've not had to deal with selling cattle before.
But your company does this, do they not? I was informed by the American Aberdeen Angus Association in Chicago that I could make arrangements to purchase a herd of Angus cattle through the Kansas City Cattle Exchange Company.
Oh, yes, we can do that. It's just, as I say, a little unusual. Though, as you want a specific breed, I suppose it isn't all that unusual. Black Angus, you say, huh? Well, I know they're doing well back in Missouri and down in Mississippi. I think you'd be the first one to run them out here. They aren't as hardy as longhorns, you know. Could be biting off more than you can chew.
Aye, they can be a bit troublesome, 'tis true. But this won't be the first time I've raised the breed.
Oh, you've raised Angus before?
Aye, I did so back in Scotland.
Scotland, is it? Well, I'm not all that surprised. I thought you sounded like a foreigner. All right, how many do you want?
I'd like 500 head, 480 cows, and 20 bulls.
That's quite an order. Let me see what that would cost. Latest price is $27.50 a head for mature cattle. You want 500 head. Let's see, that would be $13,750. Then, of course, there is the 15% handling and service fee. That would bring it to $15,812.50. Now, I'd advise you to make arrangements with your own bank for the loan, as the cattle exchange cannot extend credit.
Aye, so I have been told.
Well, now, what do you say we get your order written up? What's your name, sir?
McAllister. Duff McAllister.
McAllister? Oh, of course, I read about you in the Cheyenne Leader this morning. You are the one they were writing about, aren't you?
Aye, tis me. I had no idea 'twould be the stuff of newspapers.
Stuff of newspapers? My good man, it's stories like this that become the stuff of legends.
I've no wish to be a legend. I wish only to be a rancher.
Well, with this, it would seem to me you've made a favorable start.
Aye. Would that my trip had been only to tend to business for my ranch and none of the other.
Oh, it's obvious that you saved the young lady's life by what you did, Mr. McAllister. There's no need for you to feel remorse over it.
It's hard to be done, that's true.
The young woman who was killed, will you be going to her funeral?
I've been asked to do so by her friends at the Tivoli. I feel that I must.
And from what I've been hearing, the whole town will be turning out for it. It's to be held in St. Mark's Episcopal Church. That's a large enough church, but I don't know if it has enough room for all who wish to attend this one. I think you're going to need to get there early if you want a place to sit.
Saloons, cheap hotels, and restaurants lined 15th Street along the two blocks west of the Union Pacific Depot. It was not an area the genteel women frequented, though there was no shortage of women, for the Soiled Doves did business in the saloons, hotels, and even in small cribs that they maintained in the alley behind the buildings. Between the Western Hotel and Lambert's Cafe was a whitewashed building with a high, false front. The name of the establishment, painted in large black letters, was Eagle Saloon. Unlike the Tivoli, which had a fine mahogany bar and gleaming electric chandeliers, the Eagle was illuminated by kerosene lanterns and candles. Dingus, Lee, and Marvin, having returned from Laramie on the next train, were now in Eagle, sitting at a table near the back, close to one of the two coal stoves that heated the building from early October to late May. Although the stove was cold, the smell of coal still hung around it, and the floor immediately around the stove was stained black with ground-in coal dust.
He should have gone with us when we asked him. If he had gone with us, he'd still be alive now.
When are you burying him?
I talked to the undertaker this morning. I told him to go ahead and bury Tyler today. May as well get it over with. Ain't much sense letting him just lie around until he starts stinking.
Well, ain't you going to have no funeral or anything for him?
Nah. Tyler probably wouldn't want nothing like that anyway. Besides which, I don't know nobody that'll come, except me and you two.
We're going to have a big funeral for that whore that Tyler killed. I seen it in the paper. Whole town is going to turn out. Don't seem right. Everybody's going to be crying and blowing snot over the whore. When there ain't going to be nothing done to remember Tyler.
Oh, there'll be something done to remember him, all right.
What?
I aim to kill the son of a bitch that killed Tyler.
That ain't going to be all that easy to do. They say he was more than 100 feet away when he shot Tyler. And what's more, Tyler was standing behind a woman. So this fella McAllister didn't have all that much to shoot at.
I didn't say I was going to challenge him to a duel in the street or nothing like that. What I said was, I'm going to kill him.
Missouri-Kansas border. Crack Kingsley was born and raised in Clay County, Missouri. But when the war ended, he had left Missouri and ridden as an irregular with Doc Jennison and his Kansas Jayhawkers. The Jayhawkers told themselves that they were a military outfit, and they were organized as one, though none of them wore uniforms. And since they were what Doc Jennison called a supernumerary military unit, which he explained meant that they were not really a part of the Union Army, they were responsible for supporting themselves. That was actually the part that Kingsley had enjoyed the most. They supported themselves by stealing from the Confederate sympathizers, whether they were banks, stores, or individuals. It had meant nothing to Kingsley that the banks, stores, and individuals they stole from had been his own neighbors. Kingsley's mother had been abandoned by Kingsley's drunken father, and they had survived during Kingsley's formative years due to the kindness of their neighbors. Rather than endearing them to him, though, it had generated a sense of inferiority, jealousy, and envy. Thus, when the war started, he had no problem crossing over to the other side. When Crack Kingsley crossed the border into Missouri today, he realized that this was the first time he'd been back in the state since the war. Like the rest of Missouri, the citizens of Clay County had been divided in their loyalty. And as many of the men of the county had fought for the North as fought for the South, what upset the citizens of Clay County about Kingsley was that he had joined the Kansas Irregulars, and he had raided and killed his neighbors. Looking around him now, he knew exactly where he was. This was the old Doomy place. The house had not changed. The huge, scarred oak tree was still there. So, too, was the meandering creek. He smiled as he recalled the raid, the first raid he'd ever led. It had been in Clay County, Missouri, back in 62. The raid had started under Doc Jennison, but then they ran into a unit of Confederate soldiers led by General Sterling Price. Badly outnumbered, they paid a high price, and Jennison ordered his men to split up and make it back to Kansas on their own. Because Kingsley was a native of the area and knew it well, seven men attached themselves to him when they separated. At first, Kingsley was irritated by it. Then he realized that they had not only attached themselves to him, they were following him, listening to his orders. That gave Kingsley an idea. He would conduct his own raids. But with only seven men attached, he would have to be careful in selecting his targets. He didn't have to look far. As he and his men rode north from Kansas City, they came across the Doomy farm. Kingsley knew the man the others called the Dutchman, and he had a strong dislike for him. He had tried to come on to Alma, Doomy's daughter, but she was engaged to Elmer Gleason, one of the other young men of the county. Not willing to take no for an answer, he attempted to force himself upon her, and when she cried out in protest, her father heard her. Although Chris Doomy was twice as old as Kingsley, he was a big man and incredibly strong. He beat Kingsley to within an inch of his life and then ordered him off his farm. The day Kingsley finally came back, he was leading seven men.
Boys, how'd you like to have some roast pork, maybe some fried chicken?
Where are we gonna get that?
The speaker was a man named Bird.
Right here on Chris Doomy's farm.
You know this farmer?
Oh, yeah, I know him.
That sounds good to me, too.
All right, let's go get him.
What if the farmer ain't willing to sell him to us?
Who said anything about buying them? We're just going to take them. All right, boys, start gathering them in.
Three of the men started chasing down the chickens while the other four started toward the pig pen.
Who are you men? What's going on here?
Looking toward the porch, Kingsley saw the man who had fired him 2 years earlier.
Hello, Doomy.
Kingsley! What do you want here? I told you to never come to my farm again.
I know what you told me, old man. The times have changed, and I'm giving the orders now. We're going to take the loan of some of your chickens. Oh, yeah, and your pigs.
The hell you will! Martha, bring me my shotgun.
Kingsley drew his pistol and waited until the man's wife appeared on the porch, carrying a double-barreled shotgun.
Oh! Mama!
Alma, a young woman of no more than 18 or 19, came running through the back door. She knelt beside her slain parents. She looked up at Kingsley.
Crack! How can you do this?
Bird raised his pistol to shoot the girl.
No!
What do you mean, no? What the hell, Kingsley? Have you gone soft on us?
Soft ain't exactly the word that comes to mind right now.
When they rode away from the farm later that day, they were carrying with them 12 chickens, 2 live shoats, a sack of flour, and a sack of beans. Behind them lay the 3 members of the Doomy family, Chris and Martha dead, and Alma, who'd been raped 8 times, barely clinging to life. Kingsley later learned that she had died, but not before telling her neighbor Jesse James who had been responsible. If it had been Sterling Price's men who had found Alma Doomy and her slain parents, there would have been a charge of murder and rape filed against him. That would have resonated with the civil authorities despite the divided loyalties of the war. But it wasn't Price's troops. It was Jesse James and his band of guerrillas. And Jesse James had his own brand of justice in mind. Because of that, no charges were ever brought against Kingsley for that particular raid. And unlike the other irregulars who had ridden for the South, Kingsley had left the war with no wanted papers on him. Now, as Kingsley thought back upon that incident so long ago, he lit a cigar and stared down at the house. Jesse James had boasted that he would find Kingsley and make him pay, but he never had.
Where are you now, Jesse James? You and your big mouth. Oh, that's right. You're dead, ain't you?
Slapping his legs against the side of his horse, he rode on toward Kansas City.
You sure he's going to come through here?
Newspaper said he lived in Chugwater, didn't it?
Yeah.
Then he'll be coming through here. It's the only way he can get back home from Cheyenne.
Yeah, well, we've been here 2 days now, and he ain't showed up yet.
He probably didn't leave yesterday because of the rain. That was some rain. We most drowned our own selves. We should have found a place to wait it out.
And maybe Miss McAllister? No, sir. I ain't willing to take that chance. Well, even when we did, we're sure to be ahead of him. And when he comes...
Well, he's coming now.
What?
Way yonder. There's someone coming, one man on a horse. I would say that it's more than likely him, wouldn't you?
Where are the horses? They out of sight?
They're down in the coulee, just where you told me to put them. If that's McAllister, he ain't going to see him.
That's McAllister, all right.
How do you know?
I had someone point him out to me yesterday.
Dingus pointed to a little jut of rocks about 30 yards in front of him.
Lee, you get down there and stay out of sight until he passes you. That way, when he gets here, you'll be behind him. Marvin, you get over there behind that rock on the left, and I'll be here. That way, we'll have him from three different angles.
How will we know when to shoot?
I'm going to shoot first. And if I'm lucky, there won't any of us have to do no more shooting after that.
I sort of hope you miss. I'd like a crack at that son of a bitch myself.
Hurry, get in position before he gets any closer. I don't want to take a chance on him seeing any of us.
Duff started back home to Chugwater the day after he'd made arrangements to buy the Angus cattle. The heat was intense, and what little wind there was exacerbated more than alleviated the situation because it blew in his face like a blast from the mouth of a furnace. The land, familiar to him now because he had traveled it so many times over the last year, unfolded before him in an endless vista of rocks, sage, and hills. The sun heated the ground, sending up undulating waves, which caused near objects to shimmer and non-existent lakes to appear tantalizingly in the distance. It was always a hard day's ride from Cheyenne to Sky Meadow, and it seemed even more so now because of the heat. Realizing that he was a perfect target while mounted, Duff slipped down quickly from his horse, then slapped Sky on the rump.
Get out of here!
Bending over at the waist and running in a zigzag path, Duff got out of the open as quickly as he could, diving for the protection of a little outcropping of rocks. Once Duff was in position, he lifted his head to take a cautious look around. He saw a little puff of smoke drifting east on a hot breath of air. That meant the shooter was a little to the west, so he moved his eyes in that direction. There, he saw the tip of a hat rising slowly above the rocks. Evan Webb was returning to Cheyenne, having made a visit out to the Claymore Ranch. At first, he feared someone might be shooting at him. After hearing the second shot, he realized that he was in no danger. Curious as to what might be going on, he set the brake on the buckboard, then climbed down and scurried up the side of a bluff to look down on the other side. From here, he saw clearly that three men were accosting one. Webb had no weapon with him, but even if he did have one, he would have been reluctant to intervene. Although it looked clearly as if the big man was the one in the right, one couldn't always tell by first impressions. He decided to wait right here, stay out of sight, see what would happen. Duff wished he'd taken time to snake his Winchester out of the saddle sheath, but he hadn't. All he had with him was his pistol, and that was gonna have to do. He stared across the opening at the hat. A hat sailed away.
Damn! You're pretty good. If you waited a few seconds longer, you would have got me.
Who are you? How would you be for telling me why it is that you're shooting at me?
Tell me, Duff McAllister. Are you really so damn dumb that you didn't stop to think that if you kill someone, he might have a brother somewhere?
Would your name be Camden?
Yeah. Dangus Camden. Tyler was my brother, and you killed him. So now I'm planning on killing you.
I suppose it didn't make no difference to you that he was holding a knife to the young lady's neck. I had no choice. I had to kill him.
You had a choice. You could have waited till everyone put their money in the piano player's bowl like everyone else is gonna do. You didn't have to be no hero.
Duff's bullet sent chips of rock flying.
Ah!
Did that hurt?
Yeah, it hurt, you son of a bitch. You sprayed rock in my face.
That's the way it is, Camden. You play this kind of game, you're going to get hurt.
Hold it!
When Duff turned, he saw someone standing about 60 feet behind him, holding his gun leveled at Duff.
Marvin! Dingus! Come on out! I've got him! Good job, Lee!
Dingus stood up from his position behind a rock about 75 feet away and directly in front of Duff. The one called Marvin stood up at Duff's right, and he was somewhat farther away, at least 100 feet.
McAllister, do me a favor, will you? When you see my brother, tell him I said hello.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
Oh? And why not?
Your brother's in hell, and I don't plan to go there. Better you tell him yourself, for you're about to see him.
Ha! There are three of us and only one of you.
That's not a problem.
Suddenly and unexpectedly, Duff dropped to his knees. Startled, Dingus fired, but his bullet passed over Duff's head.
Dingus, you dumb son of a bitch, you shot Lee.
Dingus had no time to reply to Marvin's angry shout because Duff took aim. By now, Marvin had realized two things. He knew that he was all alone against Duff, and he realized that he had not yet fired. He missed. Duff didn't miss. Duff stood up then and looked at the three bodies lying in a triangular formation around him. He didn't want to leave them lying here because this was the road between Cheyenne and Chugwater, but he had no shovel either, so he couldn't bury him. He pulled all three of the bodies together, laid them alongside the road, then marked the spot in his mind. Evan Webb watched everything from his position, and he debated whether or not he should reveal himself to Duff McAllister. He knew who he was because he had heard one of the men call him by name. And it was a name he recognized because he had read of McAllister's exploits in the Cheyenne Leader. And he knew that a man who could shoot as well as McAllister would have no problem in shooting him, even from a distance. Of course, he represented no threat to McAllister, but in the heat of the moment, would McAllister know that? Webb chose the safer of the options. He remained out of sight, watching as McAllister positioned the bodies along the side of the road and waiting until McAllister left the scene. Kansas City Cattle Exchange. The building was divided into two parts. On one side, there was an area that everyone referred to as the bullpen. It was so called because there were six desks crowded rather closely together. Behind the desks toiled the inventory clerks, men who came to work and buried their heads in endless rows of numbers. The irony was that every day they added, recorded, transferred, and were responsible for tens of thousands of dollars. and they did all that for the sum of $25 per week. There was a long counter that separated the bullpen from the much larger and better decorated director's room where Jay Montgomery had his desk. On the back wall was a large blackboard upon which figures were written. The figures represented the latest quotes from the cattle market. In the corner was a ticker tape machine, and at the moment one of the clerks was standing by it, holding the tape in his two hands, reading it as it came from the machine. As soon as he got all the numbers, he would transfer them to the blackboard. On the opposite side of the counter from the ticker tape machine, one of the toiling clerks, Hodge Denman, watched his fellow employee examine the tape until he started transferring the numbers to the blackboard. Then, Denman took off his wire-rimmed glasses, removing them very carefully from one ear at a time. He polished them with his handkerchief and then hooked them back onto his ears, one at a time, just as he had taken them off. With his glasses cleaned, he reread the paragraph that was causing him such distress.
We regret to tell you, Mr. Denman, that as the expected repayment of your loan did not occur as agreed upon, we are being forced to take further action. If the loan is not satisfied within 60 days, we will have no alternative but to foreclose upon the property you use for collateral.
The loan was for $4,000. And it was secured by his father-in-law's property. Neither his wife nor her father realized that Denman was in such debt. Denman was afraid to tell his father-in-law the crushing debt because Denman knew that the man had a little sympathy for anyone who could not manage his own affairs. What his father-in-law also didn't realize was that his own property was in jeopardy. That was because Hodge Denman had forged his father-in-law's name in order to use his land as the collateral backing his loan. Denman was in debt because he had a gambling habit, a habit that had taken every cent he had and now threatened to not only break him, but his father-in-law as well. Leaning back in his chair, Denman pinched the bridge of his nose. How could he have let himself get into such a mess? And what could he possibly do to extricate himself?
Mr. Denman?
Looking up, Denman saw his boss, Jay Montgomery.
Yes, Mr. Montgomery.
We just got a telegram from Mr. Kahn in Cheyenne. There's a Mr. Duff McAllister from Wyoming who has requested to buy a herd of cattle. Specifically, he wants 500 Black Angus. I want you to handle all the details. Gather the cattle, arrange to have enough cars and a lot to move the cattle, and, of course, handle the transaction. He's been quoted a price of $13,750 plus a 15% handling charge.
I'll get right on that, Mr. Montgomery.
Denman computed the amount of money McAllister would be charged, counting the cost of the cattle and the handling charges. The total came to $15,812.50. That was a lot of money. It didn't seem fair that some people could raise that much money when he was so desperate. He drafted the letter.
Dear Mr. McAllister, this is to inform you that we have received your order for 500 head of prime Black Angus cattle. We will undertake to collect and process the cattle, then load them on cars for shipment to you in Cheyenne. Before the shipment can be completed, however, we must have in our hands a bank draft for the $15,812.50. This sum will cover all costs attendant to the transaction, to include the price of the cattle and our handling fees. Thank you for choosing to do business with us. Sincerely, Jay Montgomery, President, Kansas City Cattle Exchange.
Denman was about to put the letter in the envelope when suddenly he got an idea as to how he might extricate himself from his problems. Putting the letter in his pocket, he walked outside. Because the cattle exchange consisted of several acres of feeder lots, the odor was so strong that every morning as he came to work, Denman could smell it for a half a mile before he reached it.
How does one ever get used to that stink?
Denman spoke to one of the cowboys whose job it was to move the cattle from pen to pen.
It's all part of the cattle business. I heard someone ask Mr. Montgomery about the smell once. You know what he said?
What did he say?
He said, it might smell like cow shit to you, but to me it smells like money.
The cowboy was named Rob Howard.
What do you need, Mr. Denham?
I'm going to need 500 black Angus at a ratio of one bull to 25 heifers. That will be 20 bulls and 480 heifers.
I can do saffron, Denham.
Of course you can. I did not mean to cast any dispersions on your mathematical acumen.
My what?
Your ability to do math.
500 black Angus?
Yes.
That's a pretty big order.
Yes, it is. Evidently some rich man from Wyoming is wanting to introduce black Angus out there.
All right, I'll get them put together for you.
Howard turned to go back to the holding pen.
Mr. Howard.
Is there something else?
Yes, but this is not company business. This is personal.
What do you want?
That man you said you met a few days ago. I would like to meet him.
I meet a lot of men. Which one are you talking about?
The one you said that was a, I believe you put it, dangerous man? Kingman or something like that?
Howard looked at Denman with a surprised expression on his face.
You mean Kingsley? You want to meet Crack Kingsley?
Yes.
Why in hell would you want to meet him? Didn't you hear what I said about him? He's a border raider during the war. He's probably killed more men than you have mosquitoes.
I have a proposal for him.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
Listen to me, Denman. Kingsley is not the kind of man I would want to have anything to do with. And if I don't want to be around him, you for sure don't.
I would like to meet him.
You said you have a proposal for him. What kind of proposal?
I'm really not at liberty to say right now.
It's something illegal, ain't it? I mean, if you're wanting to do business with Crack Kingsley, it has to be illegal.
There's $20 in it for you if you set up the meeting and don't ask any more questions.
I tell you what, Denman. $20 ain't enough money for me to mess with the likes of someone like Crack Kingsley. You go set up your own meeting.
Would you do it for $100?
Damn, you're serious about this, aren't you?
I am very serious.
$100?
Yes.
Tell me why you want to meet with Kingsley.
Part of the $100 is to keep you from asking me any more questions.
Where's the money?
You set up the meeting first. If he shows up, I'll give you the $100.
You know where the Bucket of Blood Saloon is?
Heavens, you weren't going to tell me that that's where you would have us meet, are you?
You want to meet him or not?
I do.
Kingsley's pretty particular about where he goes. I reckon he's probably made a lot of enemies in his life, so he goes where he feels comfortable. And the Bucket of Blood is that place.
All right. If I must go to that dreadful place, I will. You just set up the meeting.
I damn near set it up for free just to know what this is all about.
Thank you. Let me know when you have the meeting set up.
Returning to his desk, Denman rolled two pieces of paper, separated by carbon paper, into the Remington typing machine.
Dear Mr. McAllister, this is to inform you that we have received your request for the 500 Black Angus cattle. We are now in the process of making the arrangements for you. However, it will be necessary for you to come in person to take delivery of your cattle. The amount of money due upon your receipt of the herd is $15,812.50. This sum will cover all costs attendant to this transaction, to include the price of the cattle and our handling fees. Too often, bank drafts drawn upon small banks in remote areas of the country have been non-processed due to the failure of the banks in question. Therefore, it is the policy of the Kansas City Cattle Exchange that all transactions must be conducted in cash. So we ask that you bring the money with you. We apologize in advance for any difficulty this may cause the buyer. Please advise us by telegraph when you expect to arrive in Kansas City. Thank you for choosing to do business with us. Sincerely, J. Montgomery, President, Kansas City Cattle Exchange.
Denman folded the letter carefully and put it in an envelope. J. Montgomery came up to the counter that separated the two areas.
Denman, did you take care of that Black Angus order?
Yes, sir, Mr. Montgomery. Mr. Howard is getting the herd assembled for me. 480 heifers to 20 seed bulls.
That's an exceptionally large number of cows for a single order, but our percentage will make it well worthwhile. Good job.
Thank you, sir. If you don't mind, I'll carry this letter to the post myself.
No, I don't mind at all. By all means, do so.
Duff dismounted in front of the house at Sky Meadow Ranch. Elmer met him on the front porch with a glass of lemonade.
Thanks.
You want me to unsaddle Sky for you?
Thank you. No. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ride on into town.
Oh, well, now, I'm sure Miss Parker will be glad to see you. I delivered your letter, by the way.
Thanks, but it isn't to see Megan that I'm going to town. Though if she isn't too busy, perhaps I will stop by the store. I have to send a telegram.
Well, I'll ride into town with you if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. I'd appreciate the company.
Duff filled Elmer in on everything that had happened since he'd left, including the shootout he'd had on the road on the way back home.
I left them there, so it's needin' for me to tell the police back in Cheyenne where the brigands might be found.
Yeah, if there's any justice, the buzzards will have picked their eyes out by the time they find them.
When they reached Chugwater, Duff rode directly to the telegraph office. There, using one of the pre-printed forms, he wrote his message.
To Chief Homer Davis, Cheyenne Police Department, Cheyenne, Wyoming. On my return trip from Cheyenne to Chugwater, I was attacked by three men. I don't know their names. The one was the brother of Tyler Camden. I had no choice but to kill all three. You'll find their bodies alongside the trail. Should you wish to speak with me, you can contact me at the address listed below. Duff Tavish McAllister, Sky Meadow Ranch, Chugwater, Wyoming.
Duff handed the message to the telegrapher, Dan Murchison.
Well, Mr. McAllister, let's see what the charges are.
The smile left Murchison's face as he read the message.
Oh, my, you had quite a frightening experience. And you killed all three?
Aye. It seemed the thing to do at the time.
In the city marshal's office, Jerry Farrell, the marshal, had a chair drawn up to the bars of the jail cell. He was playing checkers with Perry Keith, who was serving a week in jail for drunk and disorderly conduct. To wit, urinating in public.
King me.
Ow! You cheater!
That's not cheating, Perry. King me. Yes, sir, Duff. What can I do for you?
I just thought I would let you know that you might get a telegram from the police chief down in Cheyenne.
About the fella you shot in the saloon there? Oh, I already heard from him about that. He says there's no charges.
No, not that. 'Tis another incident I'm talking about.
Duff told the marshal about his encounter with the three men on the way back to Chugwater, emphasizing that he was attacked first and that one of the attackers was the brother of the man he had killed earlier in the saloon.
Actually, I only killed two of them. One of them was killed by Camden by a shot that was meant for me but missed. I left all three of them lying alongside the road, and I just sent a telegram to Chief Davis to tell him about it.
I appreciate your coming to me. I'll send a follow-up telegram to Chief Davis to see what's going on.
'Tis my thanks you have, Constable. I'll be around if you have need for me.
All right, but if it happened the way you said, and I've no reason to doubt you, I'm sure nothing will come of it.